Session number 875, Wilfred Page, Reel 1.
When did you join the RAF, Mr. Page?
January 18th, 1933.
Why did you come to join the RAF?
Well, I left Norfolk and there was no employment in Norfolk as a young boy. I came to London and I had several jobs working in pubs and things of this sort. Then I can remember one night thinking to myself, well, whilst I'm this age, I can get employment, but what am I going to do when I'm about 40 or 50? In those days, 40 or 50, you were quite an old man. And I felt like I've got to have some kind of security. So I thought, well, I think I'll think about the forces. So I was on my day off from the working in the pub, and I went to Buckingham Palace, and I saw the guards training out there, and I thought, well, I want a bit of discipline and security, but it looked to be a little bit too tough for me, that kind of discipline. They were really marching and hammering up and down the square. So I walked from there into Whitehall, and I got down as far as the horse guards. And I stood against the horse, and I whispered up to the bloke who was sitting on the horse's back, how do you get into your mob? And he says, oh, you can't come directly in, you have to come in via another army corps of horses. But he whispered back, there's a hell of a lot of polishing and bullshit here, I should be very careful about coming in here. And when I looked at all the harness and the beautiful, it looked beautiful, and the various regalia they had, I thought, well, I couldn't spend the next 40 years cleaning that. So I thought, oh no. And I walked further down Whitehall till I got to Westminster. And there was a policeman on standing against the pavement. So I said to him, how do you get into the police force? So he said, well, are you interested? So I said, yes, I'm looking for something with some security and perhaps a pension at the end of it. So he said, well, I wouldn't advise you to join the police force. He said, we've got Lord Trenchard has just opened up this police college at Hendon, and there's no promotion now. All the real top jobs are going to the people from the higher educational strata, and there's going to be no promotion for us. He said, I don't think I shall ever get as far as a sergeant if I stay in here for the rest of my life. So I said, well, no, perhaps not, but you've got a secure job for 21 years. It's not unpleasant, is it, walking around the streets? And he said, well, you can't sign on for 21 years now. You have to sign on for a period, I forget what it is, perhaps 10 years. He said, and you have to reapply. He said, well, the economic situation as it is, I suspect when I reapply, I shall be told no, and they'll put on another youngster in my place who will do another 10 years to avoid having too many pensions to pay ultimately. But he said, if you're looking for a job, why don't you go across the road opposite the Cenotaph, there's a little wooden hut there with a corrugated iron roof. That's the RAF hut. He said, and they're always advertising for somebody at this time of the year. In fact, I thought I saw on the notice board vacancies when I was walking past there the other day. So I walked up to this little hut and walked into a corridor, went into a room, and I saw a man sitting on a chair with his feet on another chair. He'd got three stripes on his arm and a crown on the top of the stripes. I was later to learn, of course, he was a vice sergeant, flight sergeant. And so he said, oh, I told him I wanted to join the Air Force. He said, well, he said, you're fortunate. This time of the year, we usually take on about 200 young recruits. Can he do any sums? So I said, well, I told him what I'd been doing, and working in pubs, you have to be fairly quick on mental arithmetic anyway. So he gave me some sums to do, some arithmetic to do, and I went into another room, and I remember one of them was 7 multiplied by 7, and I did that, and 3 or 4 others, and I did them very quickly and came out again, and he said, he seemed rather surprised at the speed at which I'd done these very elementary problems. So he said, well, now, can you come back at 3 o'clock this afternoon, because the medical officer of health will be here and he'll want to have a look at you. And they said, there'll be a few others there as well. So I came back again, and I got through the medical. So he said, well, now, what we want you to do, you go home now, or you go away now, come back again on January the 15th. Report here, and then we'll take you from there. So I went back to my pub where I was working on Clapham Common, handed in my notice, and went home and told my parents what I'd done. My mother was very unhappy about it. In fact, she was unhappy about me going to London in the first place, but even to go in the Air Force was far worse for her.
Why was that?
She felt frightened that the forces was a terrible thing for lads to do. It seemed, you know, it was not so long after the First World War, and of course she still got the memories of people being treated on a war footing. And anyway, she became reconciled to the fact that she couldn't afford to keep me at home anyway, because of the economics. And the last evening, I can remember, before I left for London, Mother was giving me a lecture on the pitfalls that might face me in the future in the forces.
What kind of pitfalls were there?
Well, boozing and gambling and meeting women with venereal diseases and all this kind of business. And she said, don't forget, I've brought you up as a very religious boy, and I want you to always remember what you learnt at your Sunday schools and so on. Mum went up to bed, and Dad followed her. And halfway up the stairs, Dad came down again. So he said, now look here, boy. He said, the Air Force or the Army are all right, but you don't get a lot of pay in there. Now, he was an ex-serviceman during the war. So he said, if you want to get some money, you want to go in for owning a crown and anchor board. And it was lovely to see him sitting on the hearth rug, and he drew out a crown and anchor board and explained to me that if I kept the bank, how I'd got to place my bets so that I could never lose. And this was a remarkable thing, that something that I shall never forget. This was the night before I left. However, mother came down to the station to see me off to London next morning early. And I got to this little hut in Whitehall, and there was about a dozen of us. And we all queued up, and he said he was going to march us down to, I think it was Charing Cross Station. Well, I don't know that we marched, we sort of followed the leader, as it were, down to Charing Cross Station, and then on to West Drayton Reception Centre for the RAF. And when we got there, we were handed over by the NCO that had taken us down there, and we were then handed over to another NCO. And he then started telling us, and I want to be quite fair about this, the Air Force was very fair. He said, now look here, from now till the 18th, you've got every right to leave this place. You don't have to stay. You can go out of those gates a free man. But they certainly didn't mollycoddle us. We had a terrific time there. First off, we had to go to a hut with a sack and fill it full of straw. And he said, now, I want you to fill it full, because if you don't, halfway through the night, you'll be feeling the floor. And he gave us some blankets, and it was fairly cold. We were still in civilian clothes and fairly cold. And generally speaking, it was a very tough couple of days. In fact, some of the boys did go home. They felt they couldn't stick this if this is what's going on. So we finished up. Out of about 12 that left London, I think there was probably about 8 of us that stuck it out. I suppose I stuck it out because I got no alternative. I couldn't go home and admit defeat. I'd been told them I was going to join the Air Force. And I'd got no work in London, and it was very difficult to get employment. After all, you know, there would be 30 or 40 of us applying for a job to serve in the pub in a big queue. It was this, I think, that impressed me, that I'd got to look for something else while I was at this age, because, generally speaking, I got the job because I was a youngster. And I saw men there with family responsibilities at the age of 40 or 45 being turned down purely because I was young and therefore had got the right image for working behind the bar. However, on January the 18th, in the morning, we were told At 10 o'clock, you have to be sworn in. So we all were trooped into a room, and there was a RAF officer behind the table, and we had to hold the Bible, had to repeat after him, "I shall love, honour and obey the King." It was King George V. We did this, and then we were put into a lorry, and off we went to Uxbridge. And when we got to Uxbridge, we had a meal, and may I say, the meals at West Drayton and the meals we had at Uxbridge were really marvellous meals compared to what I'd been familiar with. Because in the pubs, you worked, lived in the pubs, and they were terrible meals. And these were really very first-class food we were getting. Marmalade, I'd never eaten marmalade in my life before. There was marmalade in big plates on the table to have with toast for breakfast and this sort of thing. However, we had our lunch, and then we were taken to our barrack rooms. And there was a vacant bed next to another bed that was occupied, quite obviously, by somebody who had come down perhaps from West Drayton the day before. I didn't know him, I hadn't met him, and I put my little suitcase on the wooden locker at the side of my bed, I still had that, and then having claimed our beds, we were then taken outside and taken to the stores to be equipped with clothes, two pairs of boots, a pair of gym shoes, trousers, two pairs of putties, breeches, a wooden cane, black cane with a silver knob on the end of it, all your various equipment, knife, fork and spoon with your number stamped on it. My number was 516200, which I always to remember for the rest of my life. And then we came back again to the hut, and my neighbour, who I hadn't met yet, was in there, sitting on his bed. He was reading the Times. And on the wooden locker was a pink paper that I was later to find out was the Financial Times. And all of the people who joined up with me all seemed to have had a far better education than I'd had. So I felt that somehow or other, if I could stick this out, this would be my advantage to be, I'd be advancing my career, my life's career. Following morning, we were all pulled out of the barracks and taken down to the gymnasium. And here we learnt about why they wanted 200 recruits every year, because we had a talk from the sergeant major in charge of physical training down there to say that every year the RAF put on a display of athletics at the Royal Tournament at Olympia in June, and it was always declared there that the lads in the team had only been in the Air Force a matter of a few months from January of that year. And the next 2 days was spent selecting us and rejecting some. They sized us up and weighed us up and got us all so we were a uniform size and so on. And after this went on, the second day, the lad who I was sleeping next to was back in his bed before I was. He'd obviously left the gym earlier than I. So I said, "Were you rejected then for the team?" He said, "Yes." So I said, "Why?" Because he was a beautifully built fellow, beautiful big shoulders and a waist that came down to a V, you know, the kind of thing, a real athletic-looking lad. So I said, "Why?" He said, "You better ask the Sergeant Major when you go down there tomorrow." So I made a point of saying, "Oh, my mate who sleeps next to me, he wasn't accepted. Why?" "Oh," he said, "if you notice," he said, "what's his name?" So I said, "Oh, Dan Cohen." So he said, "Oh," he said, "if you notice, he's got a very dark skin. Now you boys are going to, as soon as the sun opens up, you will be more or less bathed in olive oil every morning, and all your gymnastics will be done outside in order to give everybody a beautiful golden tan before you get to the royal tournament in June. Now, if he went through the same treatment, he would be a very dark-skinned person and would be out of tone with the rest of your colourings. So I went back that evening and had a chat to Dan. I said, oh, I know why you didn't get selected. And I explained to him about his skin and things like that. No, he said, it wasn't that. He said, you look at the shape of my nose. And I thought, what silly fella you are. What's the shape of your nose got to do with it? And, I never took any more notice of it. Till about, I suppose it would be about 4 or 3 weeks later. He was no longer coming down to the gym and was doing some kind of fatigues or something in a cookhouse or something like this. And when I came into the barrack room, in the ablutions, I heard a hell of a commotion going on. Battle going on and swearing and cursing. And when I opened the ablution door and went in, there was Dan Cohen under a shower, and there were three or four people around him with scrubbers saying, we're going to scrub you dirty bloody Jew clean. Now, I didn't know much about what they were talking about, what it was all about, except I'd got a certain sympathy for a person who's got the odds against him. And I'd got a bit of a reputation for being a bit of a boxer and so on, so I went in on his side. We got stuck in, and with two of us being there, they went off. And therefore, with old Dan Cohen and I developed a kind of friendship after this. And he explained to me then, although at that time Hitler was on the rise, and there was a hell of a lot of talk in the papers about what they were doing to the Jews in Germany, I had not ever thought about it beyond just reading the headlines of the paper. But he explained to me that anti-Semitism was developing throughout the world, and of course it was bound to go over into our own British nation, and it was anti-Semitism that prevented him from being in our Olympia team, and this what this boy's all about. And of course I started talking to him about the Jewish question and so on, and he explained to me quite a lot. And he was an unusual character because he used to read books rather than magazines. And I remember he was out one day and I went up into his locker and I found a book called The Cloisters or the Hearth. Now I hadn't ever done any reading, of course, in my youth. And so when he came back, I said, excuse me poking my nose into your locker, but I saw a book there, Cloisters or the Hearth, what's that all about? So he said, well, you want to read it? And he gave it to me to read. And I read this, and I suppose this is perhaps one of the first classics I ever really read. We used to have a little bit at school, but very little, because we were in a village school, you see. And the Air Force was not very big in those days, of course. And during my service career, at various points in my service career, I came up with Dan, met Dan Cohen. However, we went through the Olympia, did this, and then I was posted to Biggin Hill. And this would be perhaps about August of 1933. And when I got to Biggin Hill, I was put into the orderly room as an orderly room runner to run messages for the adjutant or for anybody in the headquarters. And one morning when I went in there, there was a clerk said to me, oh, look, here's a notice here. Are you interested? He said, why don't you take a trade? So I didn't have a clue about this. And apparently the orderly room receives various orders that indicate there were certain vacancies for certain trades in the RAF, but they didn't always post them on the notice board, presumably as they should do. They just to file them away, but it so happened I was fortunate enough to be in a job where he was able to explain this to me. So I said, well, yeah, he said, there's a job going as a photographer. So I said, well, I'd like this. He said, all right, I'll fix it up for you. So he arranged with the education officer to give me a test. Incidentally, the test was rather a little bit beyond what I could do. And he came along and helped me with it. I remember this very well. And eventually, however, I was posted to Farnborough to do a photographic course. And that was one of the most exciting periods I'd had in my life, because I was, for the first time, taught science. The breaking up of light explained what a spectrum was and how a rainbow arrives. None of these things I'd ever been taught at school. And it was a tremendous experience. And of course, I lapped this up. I must confess, some of the formulas and chemical formulas and things that we had were a bit beyond me, quite heavy going for me. But nevertheless, the whole being able to do sort of systematic work, writing and thinking and things like this, was a wonderful experience. And I passed out of the photographic school at Farnborough ultimately and went to Farnborough. I hadn't been there long when I was posted to India. The note of the post came up on the posting board, you're going to India. So I had my overseas leave, I forget what they used to call it now. Embarkation leave, I think it was, yes. And I went home and had my holiday. Then I came back to Upper Hayford. I was then kitted out with khaki uniforms. No put into your kit bag, you didn't wear them, but they were ready for you when you got out there. And a big pith helmet, I remember. Topi. And then, of course, ultimately, I went down to Southampton and we went across to India on the troop ship Somersetshire.
Before we go on to the troop ship, could I ask you about some of the things about the preparation that you made for going to India? First of all, what was your reaction when you heard that you were going to India? Were you pleased or not?
I think I was pleased. I was frightened. I was nervous because India, in my school days, I'd been taught about the Orient and the mysteries of it. It all sort of worried me a little bit. But nevertheless, in the Air Force, there were quite a lot who'd come back again and had survived, although they used to tell you horrific stories about what they'd experienced out there.
What type of story?
Oh, there was the one story about where one of the old sweats told me, and I think they did this in order to create problems for you, I'm sure they did, about where the toilets are away from your barrack rooms in India because of the temperature, the heat. And the toilets are so designed that they're in a long row, and there's an Indian outside the long row walking up and down, and immediately you've been to the toilet, he takes away the pan and throws it away because the heat will make a horrible smell. And he used to say, I remember him saying to me, now, don't ever sit on that seat. Partially stand. Because he used to say that these Indians used to make a rugged edge at the end of the pan, hoping that you would sit down, they would yank the bucket out when you were sitting there, castrate you, and that's part of their process of doing away with the British Raj. I remember this very well. And, of course, I must say, they used to tell these things so seriously that, and as a young lad without any experience, you used to think, well, what kind of place is this? You know, what is, so I had these fears and so on. However...
But did you want to go on the whole?
Yes, I think I did. Yes, I did, yes. I wanted to go.
Had you ever been abroad before?
No, I'd never been further than London, and that was quite an achievement in those days, you know, to travel to London from Norfolk, except when I went to, under the auspices of the RAF, to Upper Hayford and so on.
What did you know about India before you went, apart from what the old RAF men had told you?
Well, my Sunday school teacher used to tell us that the British Empire was a very benevolent empire, that was giving a lame dog a helping hand. That was our role in the various parts of the world. And, of course, all this kind of thing I was taught. But beyond that, I didn't know anything about India, apart from that. But the preparations for going out there, we had no lectures or anything about going out there or anything. You just had your name on the board and you just went. That was all there was to it.
No lectures on the ship?
Oh, yes. When we got onto the ship, of course, it was 3 weeks or 28 days, I forget. Now, it was a hell of a long journey on the boat. I can remember when we went through the Red Sea. As we approached the Red Sea, there was a notice came on the board that they were wanting some boxing contests. As you went through the Red Sea, where it's fairly calm for boxing, you know, there was no movement in the ship. And I put my name down for this and represented the RAF on the boat, had a couple of bouts. I won the first one and lost the second one. But what attracted me was that it said on the notice that anybody who puts in for it can go onto the officer's deck and run round for exercises. Well, we were on the lower deck, and of course we were so cramped, there were hundreds and hundreds of us in a very small space. And it rather attracted me that I'd be able to have a fairly big area to run round at least a few times, you know, for exercises, you know. So that's what, so we did this. And then when we got to India, the day before we got there, we were all called on deck together, right in the front, and we had a lecture. I can't recall whether it was the sergeant major in charge of the boat or the officer in charge, I can't remember. But we had a lecture there, and we were told that tomorrow we would be disembarking at Karachi, and that you've no doubt a lot of ideas about India, but I want to tell you that I hope none of you, well, I insist, I order that none of you change any of your English money into Indian rupees by the people that you'll see on the quayside, because they're all a robbing lot of so-and-sos, and they will do you down. So don't change your money. When you want to change your money, you'll do it at a bank that we have authorized for you, wherever you are. And anyway, you won't need any English Indian money for the time being. Also, you'll find that there'll be a lot of people begging. Ignore them, because it's their religion. In fact, their religion is that they're not allowed to work. They're only allowed to exist by begging. They're a lazy, filthy lot of devils and don't have anything to do with them. Also, there'll be some women. And ignore their pleadings. They'll want to take you behind a railway lorry or a railway siding somewhere or another. Ignore all that. Well, it didn't really affect us because we were the RAF. But I think the address was mainly for the army because we were a comparatively small contingent on the boat.